Begin after six taps. One, two, three, four, five, six.
Hello, listeners. Welcome to another edition of the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. But you know who I am related to? One Mr. Gary Lampert. Gary! Welcome back.
Hey.
In addition to being one of the panelists on our very first podcast, Gary also happens to be my totally brilliant, insightful, amazing brother. All true, right?
Thank you for that. I like to think so, and, well, I'm always told that. So.
Last time Gary was here, I gave a shout-out to my mom, so this time I'm going to give a shout-out to my dad. Hi, Dad.
Hi, Dad. Hi, Dad.
Also joining us is film buff and leading expert on Catholicism, at least the leading expert in this room, Mr. Gabe Haggard. Say hi, Gabe.
Hello, Pauline. Thanks for having me.
And what does Catholicism have to do with the FlixWise podcast? You're about to find out. On this edition, we're going to discuss the ninth greatest movie of all time, according to the Sight and Sound Critics poll, Carl Theodor Dreyer's silent masterpiece, The Passion of Joan of Arc. And then hold on to your yarmulkes, because things are about to get serious. We're going to follow up our Joan of Arc talk with a general discussion about religious themes in movies. From Dreyer to DeMille to Scorsese, filmmakers have been exploring biblical stories since the birth of cinema. We're going to talk about some of our favorites and how each of our individual religious outlooks shapes the way we feel about how God is portrayed in the movies. This is kind of a heavy topic, so we're going to make sure to end this thing on the lighter side with a final note of positivity.
Yay!
Yay! All right, boys. I guess,
can I just say something about your transition there?
Yeah.
You went from talking about Catholicism and then so to hold on to your yarmulkes.
Yeah. But like to encompass all religions here.
Okay. And the Pope sort of sometimes
wears... What is his awesome hat called? His cone? What is it called?
I don't know.
He wears the giant thing. I think the cardinals, they wear something yarmulke-like,
That's
I think.
True.
The Pope has one as well.
Okay.
Bishops wear them. And, yeah, I don't know what the Pope's one is called. We can find that out.
We'll put it.
What do they say to him before there's a real shocking surprise time? Hold on to the cone thing?
I'm sure.
Well, the Pope just knows everything, so he's never shocked.
Yeah. Clairvoyant papacy.
Exactly. Time for our first topic. Today we're discussing the number 9 movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, The Passion of Joan of Arc. Released in 1928, written and directed by the Danish master filmmaker Carl Theodor Dreyer. Most of our listeners are probably somewhat familiar with the story of Joan of Arc, but just in case, here it is again. Joan of Arc was a peasant girl who lived in France around the early 15th century. When Joan was a teenager, she had a vision from God instructing her to go fight on behalf of France in the Hundred Years' War. She led French troops to several victories against the British occupiers, but was ultimately captured, convicted of heresy, and burned at the stake. The film we will discuss is a recreation of the trial and execution of Joan of Arc.
This sounds like fun.
Woo! All right, guys. What did you guys think of the movie? Did you like it? Gabe, we start with you.
Yes, I love this film. I think it's a great movie, and I think it's one of those that transcends the fact that it's in black and white and it's silent. And if I were in charge, when I grow up and I am in charge, I'm going to give all of the Oscars for all of the times to Falconetti's performance.
All right. I think that's pretty warranted, yeah. Gary, what'd you think?
I liked it, but I'm not quite as positive as Gabe. So as a whole, I didn't feel it held my interest quite as well. There's a caveat here that there are a lot of different versions of this because there's no definitive soundtrack to it. So I watched a version with no sound. So this is no background music whatsoever. So if someone asked me, should I watch this, I'd have to really know them and know what they can tolerate. That said, there are a lot of very powerful images, very powerful scenes, and the performances are excellent. And I'd have to say one of the all-time greatest casting jobs ever.
Yes.
I think you make a really interesting point about the sound. I've seen a couple different versions of it, and it's hard to say. One was with like really, really like postmodernist, modernistic, almost electronica music, and I did not appreciate that. And one was with, say, modern music, and that I didn't like that well either. But it was less offensive, and so I found myself enjoying the film more the less offensive the music was.
Yeah. So to address Gary's issue, silent film, they're called silent films, but they are by no means meant to be watched in silence. This film was meant to be accompanied by music. We know that for certain. So the fact that the Hulu version, I'm just going to call them out, maybe that's not wise. The Hulu Plus has the entire Criterion Collection in their library, and the version that's on Hulu Plus is silent. And I think this is a really odd choice, because while we do not have the definitive version of the soundtrack, we know for certain that that is not the way that it was meant to be viewed. So I'm not clear why they chose to do that.
Right. I mean, it'd be interesting. So Gabe has seen several versions. I mean, did it feel like different movies each time you watch it? Because when you watch it silently, you know, maybe if I watch it a couple of times, it'd be different. But you really have a tough time getting a sense of pacing. And it seems like, so as one might imagine, this movie is a series of interrogations. And it's hard to tell one interrogation from the next, if there's a change. You know, why is this different from before?
Yeah, in one version I saw, I found myself far less engaged in the story. You know, far less, in a way, far less interested in what was happening. But that, again, was because I was so offended by how horrible the music was, that it was like grating. I was trying to get through it as opposed to enjoying it.
Right. What did you think of it, Pauline?
I loved it. I think it's really powerful. I've seen it before with live accompaniment, and it's amazing.
When you say with live, you mean you were in a theater?
In a theater with live accompaniment, wow. Yes. So I think that's, as with most of these silent films, that's really the way to view it, and it really does enhance the experience of viewing it. But I think it's beautiful. So let's jump right in. So Gabe, what were some of the themes that struck you?
Well, I was struck on this most recent viewing by the theme of this poor little girl who had such fierce convictions and sort of the strength and heroism of Joan. She is shown at times to be vulnerable, to be scared, to be uncertain, aside from this incredible conviction she has that what she is doing is right. She was based, you know, willing to follow her convictions to, spoiler alert, her death. And you know, I felt that can kind of be like mirrored to, you know, soldiers going into battle. That sort of selfless sacrifice that I think is really powerful and really engaging and really important for people to see examples of, and to see art portraying the fact that there are times when it is good and necessary to lay down your life for something other than yourself, you know, for country, you know, or family and friends, the man next to you in the foxhole. And that's kind of a major theme that I got out of it.
Gary, how about you?
So their attitude towards her interrogators, I mean, it's seemed to be portraying time kind of an abuse of power, kind of corruption, which brings up the whole point with the movie, you know. So how would a person agnostic on the subject of Joan of Arc view her plight? Now, there are a lot of things they do in this movie to try to get these things across. Some of them are sort of movie-making tricks.
Yeah.
Many of them are.
Yeah.
So how much of do they get across through the plot, and how much are just the tricks is the kind of the interesting question. But
right.
It'd be the other side on, you know, the abuse of power, the way they bully her.
Right, yeah. I think I took away something similar, that this movie is about standing up to oppression, standing up to those who are bullying you, standing by your convictions, heroism in general. and particularly religious persecution. I think that's a major theme. And I think what Gary is getting at is, in the film, we are meant to believe that the priests and the clerics that are interrogating her are evil. But if one is agnostic on the subject of Joan of Arc, if we were to look at it from the British point of view, she is an enemy. She's a military leader.
Right. I mean, there's even the line. It should be noted that they supposedly got this from actual transcripts.
Right, exactly.
Of the actual interrogation. But there's a line in there where she's, God told me to fight on behalf of the French. And they said, well, God doesn't like the English.
Right.
And she gives an answer. And like always, it's very powerful. She's very serious. She's got those big Disney eyes.
She
with
sure
big
does.
Giant eyes, so you can sympathize with her. And and then she gives an, I don't know what it he says about, paraphrasing about the English, but he told me to do this. Now, so I don't want to step on any. So this is Saint Joan of Arc at this point. She was canonized in 1920. I just think to myself, well, that's, what would I think?
Yeah, I know. I that really did strike me this time as I was watching it, because the first time I was so moved because the visuals are so striking and because Renee Valcanetti does give this harrowing, it is this harrowing portrayal, and you are so struck by it. But it occurred to me while watching it this time that were I in the position that the clerics are in, I don't know that I would have believed her at all. I would have thought she was crazy. That being said, I want to go back to Gary's point about how the clerics are portrayed. And we know how we are meant to feel about them through the cinematography. And I think that's one thing that this film does incredibly well. Everything is shot pretty much in close-up. And we know just by looking at the frame who we are meant to sympathize with and who we are meant to despise. So I wonder if maybe we could discuss that a little bit.
Yeah. I don't know. I felt it was done so well that it wasn't, it almost, to me, it didn't have the stigma that, say, like the cowboy walking in with the white hat and the cowboy walking in with the black hat. It's undeniable. I mean, the first scene, they set up the scene and we're looking up at the magistrates and down at Joan, and so it's set up and it plays out throughout the entire film. I really liked some of the framing when Joan is brought back from the torture chamber and is bled, and then she's laying on the bed and her face is down in like the right hand corner of the film of the frame. And then the priest sitting over her is like filling up the entire frame. Yeah, I just definitely noticed that. It was definitely a tool they made use of aggressively.
Yeah, I think in this context it really works because it is a silent film. So for me, every single frame, you know how there's that cliche that, you could take a frame, any frame out of this movie and, hang it up in a museum.
I was sitting there watching. You keep seeing frames that you're like, oh, I've seen that movie poster version of it. I've seen that movie poster version of it. I've seen that. And now it's like even seeing that like hung up as some like hipster art somewhere.
I think more importantly, I think why it's so powerful is because every frame tells a story. And that was what really struck me. Not only the beauty of the cinematography, but how well it moved the plot along. You almost didn't need inner titles, I thought. Gare, what did you think?
Right. I mean, so that's undeniable. This is all fine. There's no doubt that they are able to get these emotions out of you. The question is this cheating? I mean, so a movie can make you cry if they make a dog die or something.
Sure.
But that's just kind of cheating. We don't reward movies like that.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
so what you're hoping for is you want to see a follow-up film,
right?
The Trial of Joan of Arc told from the perspective of the British.
That'd be very interesting. I don't know. But I mean, so, all praise to excellent cinematography. I can think of a number of movies. So like Kubrick, in every movie he makes the same use of that kind of right on the face cinematography. Nothing really has changed in the scene.
Yeah.
If you go right on there. And,
yeah, I'm not sure that it sounds like you were saying that you don't buy in or you don't appreciate the core of the film? You think that it's all too on the surface?
There were times where I felt like I was being manipulated. Like, you know,
oh, you are. Yeah. No. Yeah. So let's talk specifics. When we view the clergymen, as we mentioned, they're all shot from very low angles. They have pockmarked faces. One guy even has like pointy hair that looks like devil horns. They are stacking the deck a lot. This movie has very clear good guys and bad guys. That to you seems to be more troublesome than it is to us. I mean,
I don't have any real strong. I'm firmly on the fence in this one.
Okay.
This one is, I admire the way it uses all these tools, but I'm also hesitant, and sometimes when I'm watching it, I'm taken aback and, well.
Yeah, this isn't fair. These are real people. They lived 500 years ago.
Exactly. You know, who is the real underdog here?
So you're just saying that because Joan had God on her side, that you want to work with, like, root for the underdog.
Yeah. Right. You know, it's like really... the Ten Commandments. I'm thinking of the Pharaoh, and he's trying to run a country here. Moses comes in, you're a big troublemaker.
That's fair.
Yeah. So I want to talk more about the way it was shot. So it's a period drama, but it's not... I don't feel like it's typical of most period dramas that you see. It's not especially picturesque. There are no sweeping landscapes. How do you think that added to the film? The fact that there were really very few wide shots.
Similar, these are later films perhaps they're inspired, but like 12 Angry Men, how that takes the whole movie all in one room.
Mm-hmm.
You kind of just feel claustrophobic with her throughout a lot of the movie, and I mean, makes it so you can... relate to her.
I thought that it really grounded it in realism, and also it sort of took it out of time. Because we don't get as many establishing shots, it feels like it's kind of timeless. You know, it could be any time, anywhere. This is about one woman standing up for what she believes in. So I did want to get to the performances, because I think that's really, in addition to the cinematography, I think this is where the movie really, really shines, particularly the performance of Renee, I can't say it with a French accent, so you'll have to forgive me, but Falconetti.
Falconetti.
Falconetti. No, that's Italian.
Fondue.
Sounds French.
Anyway. So, I think this is rightly considered to be among the greatest performances of all time. Do you guys agree?
Yes, as I alluded to before, I think that we need to give her all of the Oscars for all of the times. The entire film is just all told through her eyes.
True. Most dramatic silent movies that I've seen, it's a lot of really broad gestures and lots of faces looking aghast, but she does it just in a look. The whole thing is her looking just off camera, and it's, as Gabe said, it's totally mesmerizing, and it's so subtle, and apparently Dreyer just put her through the ringer. So to try and get that performance out of her, apparently the whole production was just emotional and physical anguish. But I think in the end, I think it was worth it. I think he got this. I mean, you know, depending on how horrible the emotional and physical turmoil was.
Yeah, anything to get the three of us to enjoy
exactly.
her performance in 2014.
Exactly. Thanks, Carl. Good on ya.
One thing that I found so compelling is that throughout the performance and how she had built it up throughout the whole film, at the very end when she is being tied to the stake, the soldier comes up and is tying her, beginning to tie her, and the rope falls on the ground. And she bends down and picks up the rope and gives it back to him. And because it was done so subtly and so sort of offhand, but because of her whole performance throughout the whole film, I found that to be like, wow.
Yeah.
Like, you are already so invested in this girl.
Yeah.
And that was just like...
Right. Yeah.
One moment that really stood out for me was there's a fly lands on her, and she doesn't break character at all. I just immediately got this sense of her despair and, like, her rot. She can't be bothered to swat it away. So were there any other shots that really stood out to you? I know, Gabe, you mentioned a few.
When they bring her out on the scaffold for the first time and right before they get her to sign, and they say, like, Joan, you know, sign to save your life. And it shows just this one, like, guard off to the side that's just bored out of his mind. He's just sitting there like, ugh. It's like, come on, Joan.
Burn,
like,
this chick already. Yeah.
But I don't know. It was just, like, humorous. This one guard that's just like, ugh, come on.
We got four more to do after this.
It's going to rain, you know. Okay.
Yeah. You try lighting a match in this weather. Gotta get home, get some porridge, you know.
This chainmail's starting to itch. I was trying to think if there are any moments of levity in the film. And the only thing I could recall, the only laughter I could recall, was of these guards who were, you know, tickling her, and they put the fake crown on her head.
I don't think that was comic relief.
That was not comic relief. It seemed like like they were kind of molesting her. These characters were just absolutely grotesque.
Yeah, there certainly, I think you're right. There certainly aren't any moments of levity. You know, the film doesn't let up in that sense. However, there is a moment of joy, I think, when she, you know, she recants and signs the letter. And then when she tears it up, when she goes back and says no, and when she has that firm purpose, when she finally decides what the right thing is to do and what she has to do, there is a little bit of peace and almost joy, and that you can feel along with her.
Yeah. All right. And on that note, let's talk about whether we think it deserves its spot on the top 10 greatest films of all time list. It is the number 9 film. Gabe, what do you think?
I think it certainly deserves its place. And I, however, would put it above Man with a Movie Camera. Man with a Movie Camera certainly has, I think, has more camera tricks and more...
It has all the camera tricks.
Exactly. however, this film uses a smaller arsenal of camera tricks, but uses it as a means to tell a story, which I think is more at the heart of what filmmaking is. And so I would put it above Man with a Movie Camera.
Okay. One of these days, I am totally going to get after you about what you think films are for, because I think we do need to have that discussion.
Okay.
But today is not that day. Gary, what about you? What do you think?
I don't think I'd put it at number 9. Unlike you two, I've not seen the prior 8, all of them. I think I've missed maybe 2 or 3. I don't know.
You've almost got all of them, though.
Almost got all of them, and I didn't feel it was quite as watchable as, I could think of a lot of movies that are great achievements in the way that this is a great achievement, where it's more of a joy to watch. There are some times where I'm watching this and I'm like, this is a tough slog.
To be fair, you watched it without sound.
Well, you know, and I can revise my opinion when I watch it.
I think Gary's going to have to give us an update because...
Next time we'll be reviewing something else and I'll interject. It wasn't quite, you know, it was better.
Yes, I think you'll like it more with music.
Right. But, I mean, so I can think of a lot of great movies that are great achievements and... they're much more watchable, and that doesn't just mean they're happy. You know, there are a lot of movies that are very, very sad and slow that are more watchable. This was tough in a lot of ways.
Okay. I mean, was it, I think we covered this, but I think your primary issue was that it was sort of an unfair treatment of the British. Like, it stacked the deck. It was too,
it was, I know a little bit about the 15th century British, I happen to know this was a ridiculous portrayal. but
that man was a gentleman.
But I mean, I just not to put this down. It belongs on the list, but number 9 that's awfully high. I can think of a lot of movies where they're unquestionably great achievements and are also more enjoyable.
Okay, fair enough. I see Gary's point. However, I think I like it for that very reason, because it does incorporate so many visual elements to tell this story. I think I love that it's a silent film, and I love that it's told almost exclusively in close-up. It seems almost like we know it's the story of Joan of Arc, but it feels like it could be the story of any woman, any young woman standing up for her, what she believes in. And I think that's a very powerful story, and I love the way it's told. So, Ninth Greatest, I don't know. I mean, I personally like it better than Man with the Movie Camera. I'm with Gabe, so...
That is one of the ones I missed.
So, maybe you're more of a Man with a Movie Camera kind of guy. Fair enough.
I knew that the second I met you, Jared.
Yeah, I just had that feeling.
Look at this
you know?
Guy. He's a Man with a Movie Camera type of guy.
All right. The film we discussed in our previous segment, The Passion of Joan of Arc, is about an important religious figure, so I thought it would be interesting if we further discuss the role of religion in movies. We're going to talk about what types of religious themes we respond to, what we think works well and what we think doesn't work so well when incorporating God into cinema. So let's talk about that, guys. Let's discuss. Let's talk about how our religious outlooks shape how we feel about biblical themes in movies. Maybe we should start by talking about where we stand religion-wise.
Okay.
Just for clarification's sake. So, Gabe, you're religious, correct?
Yeah. So, I was born and raised Roman Catholic, and I consider it to be a very active and large part of my life.
Okay.
And sort of I try to have my religion inform everything I do.
Okay. Gary?
I am Jewish, sort of a cafeteria conservative Jew.
What does that mean?
Well, there's the old thing of the cafeteria Catholic who, you know, he goes to the cafeteria of religion and picks the rules he wants to follow.
I like that.
Right. So it plays a pretty big role in my life. And then being Jewish, it's more than just the religious part. It's also part of the ethnicity and whatnot, and your identity, the whole history of everything. But in terms of the religion, I moderate role in my life. I think about it often, and I participate in various activities.
Okay. For me, I was raised Jewish, had a bat mitzvah and everything, but I have since recovered. Just kidding. I am skeptical. I identify primarily a cultural Jew, but religious agnostic. So I think that certainly informs how I see movies about God and religion. But so, Gabe, how does your Catholicism shape how you watch movies?
Well, I mean, when I go in to watch a movie, say a religious-themed movie, I don't let it off the hook because it has a religious theme. In 2012, there was a film called For Greater Glory about a religious uprising in Mexico. The atheistic government outlawed Catholicism and started killing priests and anyone who practiced their religion. So the film is rather poorly made. However, I still watched it and found myself somewhat engaged by the story, and obviously based on the fact that I sympathized with the persecuted Catholics. So, but at the end of the day, I'm still able to have a rational discussion about it. Yeah, that was not a very good film.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like as a fan of films and filmmaking, I don't let a film off the hook and say, oh, it's great just because it is religious.
Okay. Gary, how about you?
So when there are specific movies where I might watch it, and because it's tackling a subject I learned about in school or, you know, on those occasions where I've gone to services and know about these things, I can think about it within that sort of framework. But in terms of movies that touch upon religion, I think I kind of judge them on their own merits. In fact, oftentimes, so I appreciate movies that expound upon someone's religious views and some sort of theology, and they're not even my own. This isn't even just in movies. So some of the most beautiful songs there are often written by very pious Christians, and they can make beautiful music, and I can understand it that way.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an example?
Well, Bach was very, very religious. So the Mass in D minor.
Well, I wanted to bring this up because I do feel like in recent months, even over the going into 2013, there have been several films and miniseries released that are biblical adaptations or have biblical themes. And so I wondered, I guess, Gabe, you might be able to answer to this more because many of these are New Testament adaptations. But do you think that as a Christian, are you looking for biblical adaptations? Is that something that you respond to?
I'm certainly looking for films, I would say, with moral themes. I'm not necessarily looking for specific stories, or it has to be a Catholic movie. And the Bible, both New Testament and Old Testament, has a lot of really cool stories that can be told. And so I'm very eager to see them. And so I think what's happening even now, like in the past couple years or so, as these biblical themed movies are coming out, a big push for them is they're all trying to capture the zeitgeist that The Passion of the Christ was in 2004 when Mel Gibson made that film. And sort of like open this, I mean, it's not a literal analogy, but open this Pandora's box, if you will.
Different religion, but okay.
Yes. Of this huge portion of the country that is Christian and has this incredible thirst or this vast desire and willingness to support these types of films. And so the Passion of the Christ kind of like took Hollywood, many aspects of Hollywood, unawares. Like, oh my gosh, there's this huge portion of the country that's Christian. I'm like, yeah, there is. You know, and they're willing to give us their money if we make these types of films. And I was like, yeah, we are, you know.
It's funny, I, as a non-religious person, I have no interest in seeing any of those movies, but it sounds like you, even as a religious person, are kind of hesitant to see them as well, true?
No, I'm not going to say hesitant to see them. For the most part, I'll watch them, and I'm encouraged and I enjoy the fact that they're being made, but again, like I said, I don't give them a free pass just because they're religious.
I mean, if you view movies as in any way instruct people on morals or ethics or ask interesting questions, over half of the world's population believes at least one of those books. Is a guide to this subject. So I mean, if you say, you know, making movies based off this is not okay, you're cutting off a huge portion of what a lot of people think is really important. And besides from that, a lot of it is really compelling stories. So, I mean, when they do rankings of like greatest books in literature history, oftentimes they put the Book of Job in there.
Right.
Because it's a really interesting story.
Thunder Gear.
Right. Oh, okay. What was I?
Well, speaking of Book of Job, that's actually one of my favorite biblical adaptations, is a very loose adaptation of the Book of Job. It's the Coen brothers, A Serious Man. And what I appreciate about biblical themes or movies with religious themes is when I as a non-practicing Jew, as an agnostic, I appreciate movies that deal with that struggle. The wanting to reconcile the loneliness and the difficulties of existing in a world where you see atrocities every day and you hear about atrocities every day and life is hard and you don't have the comfort of God, and if God does exist, then how does he/she/it allow all these horrible things to happen? So, but one film that I really, really responded to was A Serious Man, because I felt like it really did grapple with some of these questions. It's so mirrored how I feel about my religious upbringing, because it's about a pious man and a good man and a good-natured man who just has this bout of horrible luck. Just a series of increasingly awful things happen to him, much like Job. But in A Serious Man, there is no reprieve. Awful things happen to him for seemingly no reason. This man is clearly cursed. We don't know why. And he keeps turning to religious figures. He turns to his rabbi, and he turns, he prays, and he tries to be a good person. But ultimately, he's doomed. And I mean, I'm making it sound really bleak, but it's also totally hilarious because it's the Coen brothers. But you know how sometimes movies just, like, they burrow into your consciousness or your unconsciousness in a way that you can't really reconcile? I think that was one of these movies because it's so just hit the nail on the head as far as how I feel about religion. So, but that was one of my favorite examples. But what are some of your favorite examples of movies with religious themes?
Well, I like the DeMille Heston duo. So I like Ben-Hur and I like the Ten Commandments.
Word.
A lot of religious movies today, they kind of have like a, they try to have their provocative. Scorsese made The Last Temptation of Christ, which was really, I don't know, I'm trying to make people angry, I guess.
It was inflammatory. It made people angry, but I also think it was really thoughtful and not anti-religious. I think there is this knee-jerk reaction when it
was
comes
there?
To... Yeah, I don't... I mean, he's a
right,
pious
he's,
person. I mean,
right.
and a thoughtful director, so I think the backlash was a little unwarranted.
Okay.
So I don't know.
It could
obviously,
be.
I don't know. Yeah.
But, I mean, so the DeMille Heston, you know, those two movies... They're purely within the 1950s movie-making tradition, and they're just taking a subject. And what I take from it is they adore the Bible, they love these stories, and they're going to give it everything they got. Now, Ben-Hur is not actually from the Bible.
Right.
That's a second story, but I mean, Jesus obviously plays... Should I give a synopsis? Or
sure, give us an overview of both of these movies are like 3 hours, so.
Right, so Ben-Hur, they must have like the biggest production budget ever, because they got chariot races in this, and you know, it's what could be better?
Ponies, yeah.
If anything says religious films, it's the chariot race.
It's men in skirts.
But I mean, so Ben-Hur, so he's a prince in Judea while it's being occupied by Rome around the time of Jesus. So he's imprisoned and was made a slave for much of his life, and then he gets out, and it's about how he comes across Jesus, and Jesus saves his mother. Well, I don't know if I want to give away too much of the plot.
Spoilers. But Jesus saves a bunch of people. I don't know if you've heard.
A lot of leprosy involved.
Yeah.
Ten Commandments might have a more well-known story. This is the story of Charlton Heston, the great Charlton Heston, receiving the Ten Commandments and liberating the people of Israel. And
yes.
I like it. It's firmly within that tradition. They go big, use everything they got, and, you know, I felt it was a tribute. Plus, with the seductive Nefertiti.
Who could forget Nefertiti, played by the glorious Anne Baxter?
That's right. Very well.
Yeah, I have to say, despite how I currently feel about my religious upbringing, I still get so nostalgic every time the Ten Commandments is on, because I know I so associate it with this holiday and family and also Anne Baxter.
Yeah, I think you made an interesting point when you're talking about how they sort of unapologetically made
right.
these films. And I feel there's something to that. You know, they were made in like the 50s, and around like the late 60s, it feels to me like it stopped being cool. Like
right.
it stopped being okay.
You're right. In the 50s, many of the biggest budget film spectacles were biblical adaptations. We have Ten Commandments, we have Ben-Hur, we have The Robe. Anyway, there were a number of these big budget spectacles because, one, these are big stories, big epic stories, ripe for adaptation, ripe for the best special effects, ripe for Technicolor. So it makes sense that these would be the big budget spectacles of the time. And there are a number of people still clamoring for wholehearted adaptations.
I mean, I think everyone's aware that there's kind of a disconnect between the people who compose Hollywood and a huge portion of the country and the world. Now, they still produce a lot of stuff that they like, but there's probably a lot of people in Hollywood who would feel squeamish. So I have this image of in my mind of like the super serious method actor who's, you know, looking into his work, getting deep into his soul. I have trouble seeing a lot of these people like they want to do a biblical piece, you know, right, they want to portray a straight.
I mean, I think you're absolutely right. Much of Hollywood, or at least what we think of as quote unquote Hollywood, are people that I wouldn't necessarily be interested in seeing a religious film that they would make.
And recently, Darren Aronofsky did an adaptation of the Noah story, and religious figures have been very critical of the movie. And I think people who aren't religious aren't inclined to go see a movie about Noah. So it's really in this weird position where there is no market for it.
It's kind of interesting that they're... Well, so I was going to say, if they made a movie about Homer's stories, would they not want to see it? Then I think they did make Troy a few years ago.
Right,
and I don't
they did.
Think,
and that, yeah.
It didn't do very well, right?
It didn't make a sequel.
They didn't make
No Odyssey.
No Odyssey? Okay. So maybe they just they don't like that. But I mean, I don't mind seeing Christian movies.
I, as a non-religious person, I am not particularly interested in seeing a straightforward adaptation of a religious text. I'm interested more in exploring the ideas of religion and exploring morality and what all that entails. I'm definitely less interested in, say, seeing a big flood, because to me it's just more cities destroyed. But yeah, to me, the DeMille style of biblical adaptations seem really dated. I love them because...
To be clear, I'm not clamoring for more of them. I'm not clamoring for the sequel.
Revenge of the Pharaoh. Just a few more examples, just for all my non-religious people out there. I feel like we can't have a discussion about religious movies without mentioning a certain very dour Scandinavian. I'm, of course, talking about Ingmar Bergman. He's a minister's son, and apparently his father was... extremely critical, borderline cruel. So many of his films are very critical of organized religion. A lot of his characters are grappling with the ideas that I mentioned earlier about seeing horrible things happen to people and finding no solace in God. But one example in particular, probably among Bergman's most famous works, is The Seventh Seal. And it's about a knight who's returning from the Crusades, and he's finding his homeland is being ravaged by the Black Plague. And he's confronted, as when he arrives back home on the beach, he's confronted by an image of death. And this is the famous chess match that we've all seen parodied in Woody Allen films. But so he stalls death by offering to play a game of chess. He sets off to find meaning in his life. But what I love about the movie, a lot of Bergman movies are really bleak, and there's movies like Winter Light and Cries and Whispers, which is on our list, so stay tuned, which are really, really bleak. But this one, there is this strand of humanism and finding that meaning in other people that I really respond to. So, anything else we wanted to talk about with regards to religion and movies?
Peace. I mean, I have one more thing to say.
Yeah. No response to my whole thing about the silence of God.
I mean, we can get into that if you want. So, a lot of the films, you know, in a film, the third act should be the resolution and, you know, the tying up of loose ends and the triumph of the hero over the villain. But when you're trying to make a film about religious themes, about the salvation of man, that can be difficult because the third act hasn't happened, perceivably hasn't happened for the audience.
Right, yeah. I think that's a really good point. I think it is, a lot of movies are just reconciling that. You know, we don't know. We ultimately, there is this unknown. We don't know how it's going to end. There's a lot of differing opinions, and I think movies are a really good place to explore. Let's all lean back in our chairs, relax, enjoy some Manischewitz, and let's finish this thing off with a final note of positivity. Gabe, why don't you start us off?
So my note of positivity is colossal.com.
Okay.
It is basically the guy that runs the site sort of like curates art. Digital, video, photography, drawings, everything like that. And I don't know how he does it, but he's able to get like really, really cool stuff. And it's basically a blog, an art blog.
Yeah.
Just almost every day that I go there. And I'm not sure how often he updates it, every day, every couple days. But you just see such a, like, amazing work from like all over the world. And it's a really cool website.
All right, cool. We'll link it in the show page. Gary, how about you?
So last weekend I was visiting my friend in Boston, and I was at this, well, my friend called it, it was like a nerdy Hot Topic, but there I saw a copy of a book, William Shakespeare's Star Wars, Verily, A New Hope. The whole book is written in iambic pentameter, and it just takes the dialogue from Star Wars and just reworks it masterfully.
How about you give us a little sample, Gare?
Well, let me find a good scene here. Hold on.
There are no bad scenes in Star Wars.
Here's a good. So I don't know if I should announce who's reading each part or.
Do we need multiple people to read this?
Well, this one's Leia and Vader.
Okay.
You could do Leia if
Shall
you want.
Shall I do Leia? Okay. Here we go. Darth Vader, only thou couldst be so bold. When first my ship was under siege, I knew. 'Twas thee who had this peaceful vessel sacked. The Imperial Senate shall not stand for this. For when they hear thou hast attacked a ship on a diplomatic mission...
Highness, peace! Be thou not so surprised, for well thou know'st a mercy mission this was not this time. Thine innocent appearance doth disguise a heart with revolution at its core. Aye, several transmissions were here beamed onto the ship by rebel spies. I want to know what happened to the plans they sent, and prithee, speak thou well, or speak thou last, or speak thy last. For fairer next nice. Than thine, my hand hath crushed.
And theme.
I don't know if there's right. anything else to be said in the universe.
I didn't see the third one, but I did see The Empire Striketh Back.
Who was the author?
The author is Ian Doerscher.
Okay, Ian Doerscher.
Ian.
Ian.
Yeah.
Good old Ian.
My good Ian.
All right, I don't know how I'm going to follow that up. Thanks, Gareth. But my note of positivity is from a movie called Death on the Nile. It was made in 1978. But Death on the Nile is an adaptation of an Agatha Christie story. And it's a pretty basic whodunit. But the reason that it is my final note of positivity is... Well, let me just read part of the cast. Here we go. Peter Ustinov, David Niven, Mia Farrow, George Kennedy, Jack Warden, Angela Lansbury. But above all, it has Dame Maggie Smith and, of course, the legendary Miss Betty Davis. So, as I mentioned, the movie itself, not spectacular, but the scenes, young Maggie Smith plays a caretaker to an older Betty Davis, and they basically just trade barbs throughout the whole movie. So it's Maggie Smith and Betty Davis going at it, and they look fabulous. The clothing is amazing.
Maggie Smith was a babe when she was younger,
she
right?
She was adorable. She
I've
was
seen pictures.
Darling.
I've never seen any of it.
So check it out. She's so cute. She has the cutest haircut, I have to say. And Betty Davis is always worth watching. So that's my final note of positivity. And that's the way we frame it, FlixWise that is. Let us know what you think of The Passion of Joan of Arc in our comments section on our show page, FlixWise.com. Or you can post to our Facebook page, Facebook.com/FlixWise. That's FlixWise. Follow us on Twitter and Tumblr. We want to hear from you. On our next show, we're going to discuss one of the films on my top five list, Federico Fellini's 8.5. Until next time, Gabe, it's been a pleasure.
Always a pleasure.
Gary, thank you so much for agreeing to make an appearance.
It was my privilege.
All right. Bye, guys.
Bye.
Bye.
Even just reading that passage in the Bible, I've often wondered, because it says in the Bible that God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
You know, he let them go. He let the Jews leave. And then it says that God hardened Pharaoh's heart.
Right.
And then he comes after them. I'm like, well, what was Pharaoh supposed to do?
We have an explanation in the middle version, but hardened his heart with Nefertiti was dumped in there.
What kind of a man are you?
That's fair. That's a good point.
It's the evil temptress.
She might as well be the woman from the city.
She might as well be